This is a test to make audiobook of this book about Nikola Tesla and the so-called Venus Connection. Title, The Wall of Light, Nikola Tesla and the Venusian Spaceship the X-12. By Arthur H. Matthews, published 1973. Numbers read can be page index numbers. Part 1, The Life of Tesla. Foreword by Arthur Henry Matthews. How did the world's greatest inventor invent? How did he carry out an invention? What sort of mentality did this wonder man have? Was his early life as commonplace as most boys? What was the early training of this man from space? Was he an Earthman? Did he come from the planet Venus? Was he born on a spaceship? The answers to these and many other questions will be found in this story from the lips of the man himself. In this autobiography concerning his early youth, and so on, we obtain a good insight into the wonderful life this man led. It reads like a fairy tale, but strange as it may be, it is true. Tesla was no common mortal. He led a charmed life, given up by doctors at least three times as dead. He was a young man at 60 and at 70, with a brain just as keen the day he died, if he did die, for many believe he did not. He always said he would live to the age of 150, so perhaps he is alive on Venus. That might be easy to believe now, for if man can build a rocket to the moon or Venus, there is no reason to doubt that science on that planet could be 1,000 years ahead of Earthman's. We know that spaceships have landed on Earth, all through the ages. Tesla said that he believed he came from the planet Venus. And during the landings of a spaceship on my property, the members of that ship said that Tesla was a child from Venus. Tesla will tell you in his own words, what he believed. Read the story with care, there is a lot between the lines, as you will see. He had one great vice, his generosity. He could have been the richest man on Earth. He made and spent millions. He was an idealist of the highest order, and to such men, money itself means but little. Chapter 1. My Early Life. The progressive development of man is vitally dependent on invention. It is the most important product of his creative brain. Its ultimate purpose is the complete mastery of mind over the material world, the harnessing of the forces of nature to human needs. This is the difficult task of the inventor, who is often misunderstood and unrewarded. But, he finds ample compensation in the pleasing exercises of his powers and in the knowledge of being one of that exceptionally privileged class without whom the race would have long ago perished in the bitter struggle against pitiless elements. Speaking for myself, I have already had more than my full measure of this exquisite enjoyment, so much, that for many years my life was little short of continuous rapture. I am credited with being one of the hardest workers, and perhaps I am, if thought is the equivalent of labor, for I have devoted to it almost all of my waking hours. But, if work is interpreted to be a definite performance in a specified time according to a rigid rule, then I may be the worst of idlers. Every effort under compulsion demands a sacrifice of life, energy. I never paid such a price. On the contrary, I have thrived on my thoughts. In attempting to give a connected and faithful account of my activities in this story of my life, I must dwell, however reluctantly, on the impressions of my youth and the circumstances and events, which have been instrumental in determining my career. Our first endeavors are purely instinctive promptings of an imagination vivid and undisciplined. As we grow older, reason asserts itself and we become more and more systematic and designing. But, those early impulses, though not immediately productive, are of the greatest moment and may shape our very destinies. Indeed, I feel now that had I understood and cultivated instead of suppressing them, I would have added substantial value to my bequest to the world. But not until I had attained manhood did I realize that I was an inventor. This was due to a number of causes. In the first place, I had a brother who was gifted to an extraordinary degree, one of those rare phenomena of mentality which biological investigation has failed to explain. His premature death left my Earth parents disconsolate. I will explain my remark about my Earth parents later. We owned a horse, which had been presented to us by a dear friend. It was a magnificent animal of Arabian breed, possessed of almost human intelligence, and was cared for and petted by the whole family. Having on one occasion saved my father's life under remarkable circumstances, my father had been called one winter night to perform an urgent duty, and while crossing the mountains, infested by wolves, the horse became frightened and ran away, throwing him violently to the ground. It arrived home bleeding and exhausted, but after the alarm was sounded, immediately dashed off again, returning to the spot, and before the searching party were far on the way they were met by my father, who had recovered consciousness and remounted, not realizing that he had been lying in the snow for several hours. This horse was responsible for my brother's injuries, from which he died. I witnessed the tragic scene, and although so many years have elapsed since, my visual impression of it has lost none of its force. The recollection of his attainments made every effort of mine seem dull in comparison. Anything I did that was creditable merely caused my parents to feel their loss more keenly. So, I grew up with little confidence in myself. As I have referred, these were, perhaps, my strangest and inexplicable experiences. They usually occurred when I found myself in a dangerous or distressing situation, or when I was greatly exhilarated. In some instances, I have seen all the air around me filled with tongues of living flame. Their intensity, instead of diminishing, increased with time and seemingly attained a maximum when I was about 25 years old. While in Paris in 1883, a prominent French manufacturer sent me an invitation to a shooting expedition, which I accepted. I had been long confined to the factory, and the fresh air had a wonderfully invigorating effect on me. On my return to the city that night, I felt a positive sensation that my brain had caught fire. I saw a light as though a small sun was located in it, and I passed the whole night applying cold compressions to my tortured head. Finally, the flashes diminished in frequency and force, but it took more than 3 weeks before they wholly subsided. When a second invitation was extended to me, my answer was an emphatic N0. These luminous phenomena still manifest themselves from time to time, as when a new idea opening up possibilities strikes me, but they are no longer exciting, being of relatively small intensity. When I close my eyes, I invariably observe first, a background of very dark and uniform blue, not unlike the sky on a clear but starless night. In a few seconds, this field becomes animated with innumerable scintillating flakes of green, arranged in several layers and advancing towards me. Then there appears, to the right, a beautiful pattern of two systems of parallel and closely spaced lines, at right angles to one another, in all sorts of colors, with yellow, green, and gold predominating. Immediately thereafter, the lines grow brighter and the whole is thickly sprinkled with dots of twinkling light. This picture moves slowly across the field of vision and in about 10 seconds vanishes on the left, leaving behind a ground of rather unpleasant and inert gray, which quickly gives way to a billowy sea of clouds, seemingly trying to mold themselves into living shapes. It is curious that I cannot project a form into this gray until the second phase is reached. Every time, before falling asleep, images of persons or objects flit before my view. When I see them, I know I am about to lose consciousness. If they are absent and refuse to come, it means a sleepless night. To what an extent imagination played a part in my early life, I may illustrate by another odd experience. Like most children, I was fond of jumping and developed an intense desire to support myself in the air. Occasionally, a strong wind richly charged with oxygen blew from the mountains, rendering my body as light as cork, and then I would leap and float in space for a long time. It was a delightful sensation, and my disappointment was keen when later I undeceived myself. During that period, I contracted many strange likes, dislikes and habits, some of which can trace to external impressions while others are unaccountable. I had a violent aversion against the earrings of women, but other ornaments, as bracelets, pleased me more or less according to design. The sight of a pearl would almost give me a fit, but I was fascinated with the glitter of crystals or objects with sharp edges and plain surfaces. I would not touch the hair of other people except perhaps at the point of a revolver. I would get a fever by looking at a beach, and if a piece of camphor was anywhere in the house, it caused me the keenest discomfort. Even now I am not insensible to some of these upsetting impulses. When I drop little squares of paper in a dish filled with liquid, I always sense a peculiar and awful taste in my mouth. I counted the steps in my walks and calculated the cubical contents of soup plates, coffee cups and pieces of food, otherwise my meal was unenjoyable. All repeated acts or operations I performed had to be divisible by three, and if I missed I felt impelled to do it all over again, even if it took hours. Up to the age of 8 years, my character was weak and vacillating. I had neither courage or strength to form a firm resolve. My feelings came in waves and surges and vibrated unceasingly between extremes. My wishes were of consuming force, and like the heads of the Hydra, they multiplied. I was oppressed by thoughts of pain in life and death and religious fear. I was swayed by superstitious belief and lived in constant dread of the spirit of evil, of ghosts and ogres and other unholy monsters of the dark. Then all at once, there. Ogres and other unholy monsters of the dark. Then all at once, there came a tremendous change, which altered the course of my whole existence. Of all things, I liked books best. My father had a large library, and whenever I could manage I tried to satisfy my passion for reading. He did not permit it and would fly in a rage when he caught me in the act. He hid the candles when he found that I was reading in secret. He did not want me to spoil my eyes. But, I obtained tallow, made the wicking and cast the sticks into tin forms, and every night I would bush the keyhole and the cracks and read, often till dawn, when all others slept and my mother started on her arduous daily task. On one occasion I came across a novel entitled Elfi, the Son of Abba, a Serbian translation of a well-known Hungarian writer, Josica. This work somehow awakened my dormant powers of will, and I began to practice self-control. At first, my resolutions faded like snow in April, but in a little while I conquered my weakness and felt a pleasure I never knew before, that of doing as I willed. In the course of time, this vigorous mental exercise became second to nature. At the outset, my wishes had to be subdued, but gradually desire and will grew to be identical. After years of such discipline, I gained so complete a mastery over myself that I toyed with passions, which have meant destruction to some of the strongest men. At a certain age, I contracted a mania for gambling, which greatly worried my parents. To sit down to a game of cards was for me the quintessence of pleasure. My father led an exemplary life and could not excuse the senseless waste of time and money in which I indulged. I had a strong resolve, but my philosophy was bad. I would say to him, "I can stop whenever I please, but is it worthwhile to give up that which I would purchase with the joys of paradise?" On frequent occasions, he gave vent to his anger and contempt, but my mother was different. She understood the character of men and knew that one's salvation could only be brought about through his own efforts. One afternoon, I remember, when I had lost all my money and was craving for a game, she came to me with a roll of bills and said, "Go and enjoy yourself. The sooner you lose all we possess, the better it will be. I know that you will get over it." She was right. I conquered my passion then and there, and only regretted that it had not been 100 times as strong. I not only vanquished any craving, but tore it from my heart so as not to leave even a trace of desire. Ever since that time I have been as indifferent to any form of gambling as to picking teeth. During another period, I smoked excessively, threatening to ruin my health. Then my will asserted itself, and I not only stopped, but destroyed all inclination. Long ago I suffered from heart trouble until I discovered that it was due to the innocent cup of coffee I consumed every morning. I discontinued at once, though I confess it was not an easy task. In this way, I checked and bridled other habits and passions, and have not only preserved my life, but derived an immense amount of satisfaction from what most men would consider privation and sacrifice. After finishing the studies at the Polytechnic Institute and University, I had a complete nervous breakdown, and while the malady lasted, I observed many phenomena, strange and unbelievable. Chapter 2. I shall dwell briefly on these extraordinary experiences, on account of their possible interest to students of psychology and physiology, and also because this period of agony was of the greatest consequence on my mental development and subsequent labors. But it is indispensable to first relate the circumstances and conditions which preceded them and in which might be found their partial explanation. From childhood, I was compelled to concentrate attention upon myself. This caused me much suffering, but to my present view, it was a blessing in disguise, for it has taught me to appreciate the inestimable value of introspection in the preservation of life, as well as a means of achievement. The pressure of occupation and the incessant stream of impressions pouring into our consciousness through all the gateways of knowledge make modern existence hazardous in many ways. Most persons are so absorbed in the contemplation of the outside world that they are wholly oblivious to what is passing on within themselves. The premature death of millions is primarily traceable to this cause. Even among those who exercise care, it is a common mistake to avoid imaginary and ignore the real dangers. And what is true of an individual also applies, more or less, to a people as a whole. Abstinence was not always to my liking, but I find ample reward in the agreeable experiences I am now making. Just in the hope of converting same to my precepts and convictions, I will recall one or two. A short time ago, I was returning to my hotel. It was a bitter cold night, the ground slippery, and no taxi to be had. Half a block behind me followed another man, evidently as anxious as myself to get under cover. Suddenly my legs went up in the air. At the same instant there was a flash in my brain. The nerves responded, the muscles contracted. I swung through 180 degrees and landed on my hands. I resumed my walk as though nothing had happened when the stranger caught up with me. "How old are you?" he asked, surveying me critically. "Oh, about 59, I replied. "What of it?" "Well," said he, "I have seen a cat do this but never a man. About a month ago, I wanted to order new eyeglasses and went to an oculist who put me through the usual tests." He looked at me incredulously as I read off with ease the smallest print at considerable distance. But when I told him I was past 60, he gasped in astonishment. Friends of mine often remark that my suits fit me like gloves, but they do not know that all my clothing is made to measurements which were taken nearly 15 years ago and never changed. During this same period, my weight has not varied 1 pound. In this connection, I may tell a funny story. One evening, in the winter of 1885, Mr. Edison, Edward H. Johnson, the president of the Edison Illuminating Company, Mr. Batchelor, manager of the works, and myself, entered a little place opposite 65 Firth Avenue, where the offices of the company were located. Someone suggested guessing weights and I was induced to step on a scale. Edison felt me all over and said, "Tesla weighs 152 pounds to an ounce," and he guessed it exactly. Stripped, I weighed 142 pounds, and that is still my weight. I whispered to Mr. Johnson, "How is it possible that Edison could guess my weight so closely?" "Well," he said, lowering his voice, "I will tell you confidentially, but you must not say anything. He was employed for a long time in a Chicago slaughterhouse where he weighed thousands of hogs every day. That's why. Mr. Friend, the Honorable Chauncey M. Dubew, tells of an Englishman on whom he sprung one of his original anecdotes and who listened with a puzzled expression but a year later, laughed out loud. I will frankly confess it took me longer than that to appreciate Johnson's joke. Now, my well-being is simply the result of a careful and measured mode of living, and perhaps the most astonishing thing is that 3 times in my youth I was rendered by illness a hopeless physical wreck and given up by physicians. More than this, through ignorance and light-heartedness, I got into all sorts of difficulties, dangers, and scrapes from which I extricated myself as by enchantment. I was almost drowned a dozen times, was nearly boiled alive and just missed being cremated. I was entombed, lost and frozen. I had hairbreadth escapes from mad dogs, hogs, and other wild animals. I passed through dreadful diseases and met with all kinds of odd mishaps, and that I am hale and hearty today seems like a miracle. But as I recall these incidents to my mind, I feel convinced that my preservation was not altogether accidental, but was indeed the work of divine power. An inventor's endeavor is essentially life-saving. Whether he harnesses forces, improves devices, or provides new comforts and conveniences, he is adding to the safety of our existence. He is also better qualified than the average individual to protect himself in peril, for he is observant and resourceful. If I had no other evidence that I was, in a measure, possessed of such qualities, I would find it in these personal experiences. The reader will be able to judge for himself if I mention one or two instances. Part 1, Chapter 2. On one occasion, when about 14 years old, I wanted to scare some friends who were bailing with me. My plan was to dive under a long floating structure and slip out quietly at the other end. Swimming and diving came to me as naturally as to a duck, and I was confident that I could perform the feat. Accordingly, I plunged into the water and, when out of view, turned around and proceeded rapidly towards the opposite side. Thinking that I was safely beyond the structure, I rose to the surface but to my dismay struck a beam. Of course, I quickly dived and forged ahead with rapid strokes until my breath was beginning to give out. Rising for the second time, my head came again in contact with a beam. Now I was becoming desperate. However, summoning all my energy, I made a third frantic attempt, but the result was the same. The torture of suppressed breathing was getting unendurable, my brain was reeling, and I felt myself sinking. At that moment, when my situation seemed hopeless, I experienced one of those flashes of light and the structure above me appeared before my vision. I either discerned or guessed that there was a little space between the surface of the water and the boards resting on the beams and, with consciousness nearly gone, I floated up, pressed my mouth close to the planks and managed to inhale a little air, unfortunately mingled with a spray of water which nearly choked me. Several times, I repeated this procedure as in a dream until my heart, which was racing at a terrible rate, quieted down, and I gained composure. After that, I made a number of unsuccessful dives, having completely lost the sense of direction, but finally succeeded in getting out of the trap when my friends had already given me up and were fishing for my body. That bailing season was spoiled for me through recklessness, but I soon forgot the lesson, and only 2 years later, I fell into a worse predicament. There was a large flour mill with a dam across the river near the city where I was studying at that time. As a rule, the height of the water was only 2 or 3 inches above the dam, and to swim to it was a sport not very dangerous, in which I often indulged. One day I went alone to the river to enjoy myself as usual. When I was a short distance from the masonry, however, I was horrified to observe that the water had risen and was carrying me along swiftly. I tried to get away, but it was too late. Luckily, though, I saved myself from being swept over by taking hold of the wall with both hands. The pressure against my chest was great and I was barely able to keep my head above the surface. Not a soul was in sight and my voice was lost in the roar of the fall. Slowly and gradually, I became exhausted and unable to withstand the strain longer. Just as I was about to let go, to be dashed against the rocks below, I saw in a flash of light a familiar diagram illustrating their hydraulic principle, that the pressure of a fluid in motion is proportionate to the area exposed, and automatically I turned on my left side. As if by magic, the pressure was reduced and I found it comparatively easy in that position to resist the force of the stream. But, the danger still confronted me. I knew that sooner or later I would be carried down, as it was not possible for any help to reach me in time, even if I had attracted attention. I am ambidextrous now, but then I was left-handed and had comparatively little strength in my right arm. For this reason I did not dare to turn on the other side to rest, and nothing remained but to slowly push my body along the dam. I had to get away from the mill towards which my face was turned, as the current there was much swifter and deeper. It was a long and painful ordeal, and I came near to failing at its very end, for I was confronted with a depression in the masonry. I managed to get over with the last ounce of my strength and fell in a swoon when I reached the bank, where I was found. I had torn virtually all the skin from my left side, and it took several weeks before the fever had subsided and I was well. These are only two of many instances, but they may be sufficient to show that had it not been for the inventor's instinct, I would not have lived to tell the tale. Interested people have often asked me how and when I began to invent. This I can only answer from my present recollection, in the light of which, the first attempt I recall was rather ambitious, for it involved the invention of an apparatus and a method. In the former, I was anticipated, but the latter was original. It happened in this way: one of my playmates had come into the possession of a hook and fishing tackle, which created quite an excitement in the village, and the next morning all started out to catch frogs. I was left alone and deserted wing to a quarrel with this boy. I had never seen a real hook and pictured it as something wonderful, endowed with peculiar qualities, and was despairing not to be one of the party. Urged by necessity, I somehow got hold of a piece of soft iron wire, hammered the end to a sharp point between two stones, bent it into shape, and fastened it to a strong string. I then cut a rod, gathered some bait, and went down to the brook where there were frogs in abundance. But I could not catch any, and was almost discouraged when it occurred to me to dangle the empty hook in front of a frog sitting on a stump. At first, he collapsed, but by and by his eyes bulged out and became bloodshot. He swelled to twice his normal size and made a vicious snap at the hook. Immediately I pulled him up. I tried the same thing again and again, and the method proved infallible. When my comrades, who in spite of their fine outfit had caught nothing, came to me, they were green with envy. For a long time I kept my secret and enjoyed the monopoly, but finally yielded to the spirit of Christmas. Every boy could then do the same, and the following summer brought disaster to the frogs. In my next attempt, I seemed to have acted under the first instinctive impulse, which later dominated me, to harness the energies of nature to the service of man. I did this through the medium of May bugs, or June bugs as they are called in America, which were a veritable pest in that country and sometimes broke the branches of trees by the sheer weight of their bodies. The bushes were black with them. I would attach as many as four of them to a crosspiece, rotably arranged on a thin spindle, and transmit the motion of the same to a large disc, and so derive considerable power. These creatures were remarkably efficient, for once they were started, they had no sense to stop and continued whirling for hours and hours, and the hotter it was, the harder they worked. All went well until a strange boy came to the place. He was the son of a retired officer in the Austrian army. That urchin ate maybugs alive and enjoyed them, as though they were the finest blue point oysters. That disgusting sight terminated my endeavors in this promising field, and I have never since been able to touch a maybug or any other insect for that matter. After that, I believe, I undertook to take apart and assemble the clocks of my grandfather. In the former operation, I was always successful, but often failed in the latter. So it came that he brought my work to a sudden halt in a manner not too delicate, and it took 30 years before I tackled another clockwork again. Shortly thereafter, I went into the manufacture of a kind of pop gun, which comprised a hollow tube, a piston, and two plugs of hemp. When firing the gun, the piston was pressed against the stomach and the tube was pushed back quickly with both hands. The air between the plugs was compressed and raised to high temperature, and one of them was expelled with a loud report. The art consisted in selecting a tube of the proper taper from the hollow stalks, which were found in our garden. I did very well with that gun, but my activities interfered with the window panes in our house and met with painful discouragement. If I remember rightly, I then took to carving swords from pieces of furniture, which I could conveniently obtain. At that time, I was under the sway of the Serbian national poetry and full of admiration for the feats of the heroes. I used to spend hours in mowing down my enemies in the form of corn stalks, which ruined the crops and netted me several spankings from my mother. Moreover, these were not of the formal kind, but the genuine article. I had all this and more behind me before I was 6 years old and had passed through 1 year of elementary school in the village of Smiljan where my family lived. At this juncture we moved to the little city of Gospic nearby.